Welcome to the City Club of Eugene, September 20th, 2019 program. Building Workforce Housing in Eugene. This is the third program of our 2019-2020 programming year. My name is Eric Richardson, president of the City Club of Eugene. Support for the City Club is provided by members and sponsors alike. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. You are also welcome to present any ideas around programming on our website. Just look for the tab around programming. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, who exists to provide high-quality, affordable healthcare services and to improve the health of our members and the community we serve. For more information, check out www.kp.org. The University of Oregon. Since 1876, the university has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health. They are proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown healthcare provider for more than 80 years, it is their mission to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. We also want to thank our new diamond sponsor, Lane Community College. We're proud to have received their sponsorship and recognize them as a great institution of higher learning in our community. We'd also like to thank our Sapphire sponsor, Johnson, Johnson, Lucas, and Middleton. Support for the City Club comes from the law offices of Johnson, Johnson, Lucas, and Middleton, whose mission is to obtain justice and fair compensation for people who have been harmed because of someone's wrongful conduct. For more information, contact justicelawyers.com. Now on with our program. I'd like to welcome to the podium John Belchers, who is today's program coordinator and who will introduce today's guest speakers.
Eugene, we have a problem, a housing problem. Of course, your first response to that might be, well, sure, we see homeless people every day. We already know about that. Well, while we certainly have a homelessness problem, and several agencies are working on feeding and housing folks at the bottom of the economic scale, our housing costs have grown to the point that approximately 60% of Eugene Springfield households are having a hard time paying the cost of their living space. This crisis has worked its way into our essential workers, nurses, medical personnel, police officers, firemen, and teachers, among others, who neither qualify for affordable housing nor earn enough to buy or rent housing in Eugene without being cost burdened, creating the need for a new term for their needs, workforce housing. Today we'll hear from two individuals, architect Karen Knutson of Better Housing Together and workforce analyst Henry Fields of the Oregon Employment Department, who will speak to workforce housing and why so many of our neighbors are struggling to afford a place to buy or rent, and they will also suggest ways we can deal with that problem. So who are these people? Karen Knutson is the project lead for Better Housing Together, a consortium of community partners working to find a better range of housing types to support people of all ages, all income levels in our community. She has a master's degree in architecture and is an assistant professor in that program. She's also on the board of directors for the Architecture Foundation of Oregon. Henry Fields is a workforce analyst economist at the Oregon Employment Department in Springfield. He received a BA in poli-sci at the University of Oregon and a master's in public administration from the University of Indiana. So let me get out of the way and have Henry come up and tell you what you need to know. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John. So my name is Henry Fields, and my role is as a workforce analyst for the local area for businesses, education providers, and the public in Lane County. So what that means is I provide data on analyze the local economy and especially the workforce. Building workforce housing in Eugene. I could spend every minute up here defining exactly what we mean by that, but I want to focus on what we mean by workforce and what we mean by housing as a way to look at the parameters that define these issues locally. So I'm going to talk about the structural forces that make our workforce what it is and how that interacts with housing. And then Karin will cover how that meets the reality on the ground in Eugene, what some might call the interesting part of discussion. I'm going to discuss three broad areas that define the challenge locally: makeup of the workforce, local building, and wages. So first, who is our workforce? A primary characteristic of our economy is that people move here, a lot and from all over. When people imagine who's moving to Eugene, you often hear a lot of grousing about retirees moving from California. While that's not uncommon, that's far from the typical story. I have moved to Eugene twice in my life, and my story in both instances has been fairly typical. So I first moved from Coos Bay to attend college in Eugene and stayed a year or two after. So rural Southern Oregon sends a lot of people to Lane County to attend school, for a job, for retirement, and it's rarer for them to move back. Okay. Later in life, I moved back for this job after living in Massachusetts for a few years. More people move out of states in the Northeast and Midwest than move to them, and they're often headed to places in the South and West. That's especially true in Oregon. Almost every state sends more people to Oregon each year than it receives. So Oregon and Lane County are places that people want to move to and have been for quite a while. On average in the 2010s, Lane County is adding about 3,000 to 4,000 people a year. It's not the fastest that we've ever grown. Probably the 90s was a little bit higher, but it's pretty close. And what's a little different from the 1990s is that more than 95% of our population growth comes from net migration, people moving here minus the people who move away. Not natural growth, which is the number of people born minus the number of people who die. So more than 19 out of 20 people added to our population since 2010 moved here from elsewhere. In that respect, we're dependent on net migration for our population growth. That growth, of course, brings its challenges, but it also brings large benefits. Migration adds to our workforce and builds demand for local goods and services. And definitely a sustained competitive advantage for our area is the fact that people want to move here, which makes it easier for businesses to recruit talented workers or replace workers who are retiring. And that's very important because, like many places in the U.S., we face an aging population and the struggle to fill positions due to retirements. So a few data points that kind of help demonstrate what that looks like. Replacements, which include retirements as well as people that leave their field to work in another, make up more than 90% of the job openings projected in our area in the next 10 years. Who is working has also changed. In 1995, 10% of workers were 55 and older. In 2018, it was about 25%. That's not necessarily bad, but it does mean that businesses need to think carefully about succession planning in their workforce. So our migration in many respects makes us relatively lucky. Many areas would very much like to be attracting as many people as we are here. Let's pivot to where that workforce growth interacts with our housing market. If our population is growing almost as fast as it was in the 90s, we are on average every year of the 2010s building 50% less housing than we did during the 1990s. And that means that we're still in the long hangover from the Great Recession. Building plummeted during 2008 and to 2012. And it's come back quite a bit in recent years, but still hasn't fully recovered. As a way to kind of demonstrate what that looks like, we still haven't permitted as many units in any single year since 2008 as we did in every year from 1993 to 2007. So that means the gap between supply and demand is struggling to kind of get any smaller, even as we build more. So there are a lot of people moving here, and we're not building as much as we used to. The result that we've seen is that the cost of our housing is higher than the nation as a whole, and also many times in recent years, that cost has been rising faster as well. The median home value in Lane County is about $300,000 and about $230,000 in the United States. So the home in the middle of our housing stock is about 30% more expensive here. That would be a bit easier to swallow for our local workforce if wages were 30% higher, but unfortunately they aren't. So let's talk a little bit now about what's going on with wages, another really critical element of our labor market. The average wage per employee in the U.S. is about $57,000. In Oregon, it's a bit lower at about $53,000. And in Lane County, it's lower still at about $44,000. We'll get more into that issue in a second, but first to kind of cover my bases, there are a lot of different ways to look at income and wages, and I don't want you to think that I've just cherry-picked one example of this. Since we're talking about housing, the single best measure for income is probably median household income, which doesn't include, for example, students living on the U of O campus, includes different types of income, including retirement income, and accounts for houses where multiple people have jobs. In the U.S., the median household income is $58,000. In Lane County, the most recent data has us at about $48,000, about 20% lower. Our wages are lower here in Oregon and Lane County, and there are a lot of factors here that make that a thorny issue to solve. So I'm trying to encourage people to look at this issue as having more than one cause. Oregon really started to diverge from the nation as a whole in the 1980s in the depth of a recession that was especially severe here. And while we've seen some gains in the last 5 years of economic growth, we still haven't closed that gap locally. A few reasons for this. One, locally, jobs in industries like RV manufacturing, wood products, and forestry have suffered deeply in the last few recessions and haven't fully returned to previous levels over time. Sometimes this is because of efficiency improvements that allow businesses to operate with less labor. Second, our industries tend to pay less than they do in other areas. I don't have much time to get into the many explanations as to why that might be the cause, why that might be the case, but one practical example of that is that our wage ceiling is lower for a lot of technical positions, especially things like legal and business occupations. Although this isn't true in all industries, for example, healthcare workers earn more than average here. Third, we also have a greater concentration of jobs that tend to pay lower, like personal care and service and community and social service. This is important to keep in mind because even if we add more jobs at the top in a high-paying field like tech or healthcare, we still have a broad base of jobs in lower-paying industries that need to be able to afford to live here. Even at the top of their earning potential, they struggle to make ends meet. So in short, wages make the answer to housing affordability more complex. While it's one of a number of important issues we need to keep an eye on, simply wishing that we could increase our average wages is unlikely to be effective. So to zoom out and do some simplistic calculations to show the scale of the issue. Zillow Research calculates the median unit rent in Lane County to be $1,572. If we use the standard rule of thumb of paying no more than 30% of your income on rent, that would work out to a household income of $63,000 a year. And as John mentioned, that would be unaffordable to more than 60% of Lane County households. Purchasing a house is often even further from a local worker's grasp. At about $300,000, saving a 20% down payment of $60,000 would be very difficult on the salary of many of our most in-demand jobs. Keep that $60,000 in mind when you think about these scenarios. The median annual wage of a preschool teacher working full-time year-round is $26,500. In the next 10 years, we'll need 800 new preschool teachers, with more than 700 of those being replacements. The median carpenter earns about $45,000. We'll need 1,600 carpenters to build the homes of the future, 1,300 of which will be replacements of current workers. The median wage for a personal care aide, the workers who take care of us in our homes or in a care facility when we need daily assistance, is $27,000. There will be 4,600 more personal care aide openings by 2027, including 4,000 replacements. These are just some examples of what we're talking about when we think about the housing needs of the workforce that we already have and the workforce that we'll need to have in the future. So, on that cheery note, I'm going to hand it off to Karin to move from the top line numbers to the reality of the situation on the ground.
Thank you. So, Henry laid out the background and the context with regards to our local workforce, and that's really the data that we need to understand our field position, so to speak. But I'm Karin Knutson. I'm an architect and an urban designer and the project lead of Better Housing Together, as John mentioned, which is a community initiative that's working to collaboratively address housing affordability, diversity, and supply. And the needs of our workforce is an incredibly important part of that effort. We care about housing as a community. So how can we demonstrate that care in action? These are really some of the biggest questions that we have to ask ourselves right now. What strategies can we pursue? What policies can we pursue that would support families, individuals, working families to increase their stability and to increase housing affordability in this community? So I'll share some thoughts about efforts that are underway in Eugene and that have been underway here for a number of years, but also some recent work from around the state and some approaches that are being pursued in other communities, because every community is grappling with this challenge of affordability and how to set foundations that will allow for a future that has increased access to opportunity and chances for individuals and families to thrive. So I said the word foundations, so to talk about workforce housing, I want to pause and ask you to think a little bit about cathedrals. And specifically, I want you to think about a concept I was introduced to earlier this week, which is cathedral thinking. And I think it's a beautiful way of capturing a community's willingness and ability to begin work on an enormous task and an incredible challenge, even when they're not exactly sure how they will get to that finish line. And they're not sure if it will be in a year, in a decade, or even in their lifetime. But it's work worth doing, and it's work that we need to do in facing all of the kinds of structural challenges that are upon us. If that's the housing crisis, climate change, social injustice, homelessness, it takes courage to begin the work, to try new ideas, and not to be distracted by the scope of the problem. So that's what we're trying to work on locally. And when I think about the future of Willamette Valley in Oregon, I think this idea catches me. It's part of being truly invested in place. And when we're thinking about investments in our community, that relates directly to how we are also looking to pay forward that same opportunity for others to then invest in this community and invest in place. In saying all of that, I also want to be clear that in focusing today's conversation on workforce housing, that by no means diminishes the importance or seriousness of other aspects of the housing crisis in this community, particularly the issue of homelessness, sheltered and unsheltered. Research has clearly established the link between communities with a scarce and inaccessible housing profile such as ours and the high incidence of homelessness, and we need to, of course, continue that work with urgency. But to address the structural crisis we face with housing, we have to be able to do more than one thing at a time, and we have to care about more than one issue at a time. And housing for our workforce and low and middle incomes is an incredibly important part of that. So in Better Housing Together's work, we always try to talk about affordability and diversity and supply of housing, those three issues together, because we have to use those issues together and work on those three issues together in order to address this crisis. And here's a little bit of background, maybe about those three terms and how they relate to households earning lower and median incomes. One is the idea of housing affordability. And Henry provided a lot of background to that issue and how it presents locally in our workforce. Housing affordability is a function of housing price and income. It is different from affordable housing. It's talking about what is accessible and available to you, housing you can afford based on your income. When there's very little housing available in a community and very little diversity of housing available in a community, that has a very negative impact on the affordability of housing, because people with more resources will compress the availability of housing in that market, which will then drive affordability further out of reach for many people. Based on historical nationwide averages under healthy economic conditions, the rule of thumb used to be that you would be able to afford a house if its price was equivalent to roughly 2.6 years of your household income. If you purchased a home in Eugene maybe 30 years ago, that could have been true. Today, that number is 5.1 years, which makes it not a relevant reference point for people attempting to build equity in housing in this community. And it's important also to remember that affordability is about more than just the cost of the housing. The location of the housing is incredibly important. Currently, 60% of a median household's income goes to housing and transportation costs alone. In a state with incredibly high childcare costs, that leaves almost nothing available for the other needs of that household and families. Historically, our workforce housing was situated in places where it would be easier for workers to access their jobs, most typically along public transit of some kind. And it's another reason why our local efforts to support 20-minute neighborhoods and walkable neighborhoods is so important. To deliver increased affordability, we also need to design towards affordability, and that will mean smaller homes and more energy-efficient homes. This is part of the benefit of missing middle housing or micro housing or micro dwelling, the idea that these homes cost less and use less energy to build and also to maintain over time. And every year, using less energy to operate, they emit fewer carbon emissions, and the residential sector is the single greatest opportunity for us to impact carbon emissions. Why is that? It's because when you think about the area of land we are occupying, more than 90% of urban areas with our residential uses of land, when you increase the efficiency across that amount of area, even just a little bit, even one ADU on each block, you see enormous returns on that simple investment. In terms of diversity, a lot of what has happened related to housing in the last year in Oregon has had to do with encouraging diversity. The Oregon legislative session concluded with several new laws that were written to support increased affordability, to protect renters from no-cause evictions, and to address the statewide housing crisis. House Bill 2001, allowing or re-legalizing duplexes in single-family neighborhoods, was one piece of that work. And that bill's component that also states that missing middle housing should be allowed. Is it going to be a big piece of what Eugene has to do, what this community has to work on in the coming years to implement? It is a state law that is designed to help us grapple with these challenges, and now we have the responsibility of doing the work to implement them sensibly on the ground, with the goal being to provide more housing, to increase affordability, and to provide more shelter to more people who need it. That was at the state level, but locally there's also been a lot of other work underway related to housing diversity for some time. In 2018, about a year ago, the Eugene City Council initiated a public process that lasted about 4 months of workshops with a stakeholder group of close to 40 people, I believe, to grapple with the issues of housing affordability, availability, and diversity at all income levels. This is a very diverse range of perspectives that the City Council brought together. And I think their goal was simply to find out what kinds of things do most people want for us to work on? Where do they see opportunities? And these were builders, educators, social service providers, young professionals, architects, myself, business leaders, environmental activists, a very wide range of perspectives in that room. And what came out of those recommendations fell into three broad categories. The first category was to remove barriers to housing in the land use code, and because the analysis of our existing code found that we're pretty inflexible in terms of actually allowing the types of housing that many of our policies say we want to encourage. Smaller, more energy efficient, infill housing. We have a lot of work to do to get our code in line with those objectives, and there's a process underway with the city's code audit to try and make more sense out of that regulatory structure. The second set of recommendations had to do with reducing the cost and time burden for development of housing units. What the analysis found in the conversation, also through discussion in that work group, is that we are not very good at delivering housing units on the ground in this community. There's still a lot of conflict around whether or not we actually think the unit of housing is a good idea. The building of a home is a good idea. The having of an ADU, is that a good idea? We think it's a really good idea, and there are a lot of good reasons for that if your goals are sustainability, affordability, sociability, support of communities aging in place, financial stability for families and households of all different types. So this work group was very clear that we needed to move forward in removing some of those barriers and burdens and trying to be more efficient in our delivery of housing units. And then third, there was a lot of recommendations around increasing the inventory and supply of capital A, capital H affordable housing. And that really has to do with specifically focusing on policies and efforts that would provide more explicitly and permanent subsidized affordable housing. So lastly, a little bit about supply and also about other ideas that we might pursue to encourage these three things. Where does most of our workforce housing come from? Most of it comes from the housing that was built 20 or 30 or more years ago. Most of it is housing that has aged in this community over time and become more affordable over time. It was mostly built by the private sector. It is likely apartment buildings, small quads, little apartment blocks or fourplexes that you might see on some of our older streets. And it has been an incredibly important part of meeting our community's housing needs over many decades of time. Different households have transitioned through that housing. In terms of supply, we are far behind the curve, and in other ways connects back to some of what Henry was saying regarding our present housing needs and the supply of housing from 20 and 30 years ago. That same recession in the 80s also impacted the housing that was being built here locally and the affordability of that housing as it's available today. So just lastly, and we will talk more, I think, in the Q&A about other strategies that we might pursue. These issues steer us back to affordability by design, doing more work in our community and in our policies to support housing that can be achieved and built by both the private and public sector at a lower cost in its first instance, and all of the different types of programs and initiatives that we can pursue that would support that. We have to make it easier to get what we want. We need that kind of clarity in our policy work around housing. And we are excited to keep working on that in the years ahead. So we'll look forward to your questions, and hopefully I'm sure there will be some good ones.
All right, thank you, Karen and Corinne and Henry. We're gonna take a small break now so that we can formulate our questions, and we'll be right back. Thank you.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. It's time for questions, and I guess I'm going to be our first questioner today, and I have a question for both of our two guests. My first question for Henry is that if our wages are so low in Eugene Springfield, what can we do to make them higher?
All right, this is Henry Fields. That is the million-dollar question, if you'll excuse the pun. That is basically, it's one of the major economic issues we face, and there are unfortunately not a lot of easy solutions and probably a lot of different causes that go into the fact that our wages are lower. But they are undeniably lower here than they are in many places in the U.S. So to talk about the various issues that might cause it, a lot of it has to do with the fact that we have, like I said, haven't replaced the jobs that have left during previous recessions with jobs that pay at that same level. And that's a very difficult thing to just flip a switch on, obviously. But there are also lots of other explanations that might be playing a part that are similarly very difficult to just change overnight. So a great example, I said in my presentation that legal and business occupations tend to pay less here and that healthcare occupations pay more. Some people theorize that the university has some role in that because they put out a lot of graduates in legal and business fields and kind of flood the local market, meaning that wages become lower because of that. That may play some role in it. There's some evidence for that. But again, the answer is not simply that the U of O will stop putting out graduates in those fields. It's just something that we have to keep an eye on. Finally, I kind of find that everybody has their pet theory for why wages are low. And I would, again, just encourage people to think about that these are all very multifaceted issues. One I hear very commonly, which I don't personally find very compelling, is that our quality of life is very high here, so businesses can afford to pay lower because it's just so nice to live here. So the response to that would be, I suppose we could make our quality of life a lot worse, or we could, but no, I don't think that that's a very compelling kind of overall explanation, because there are plenty of places that are beautiful places to live that pay more than us. It's just it's a multifaceted question that we kind of all have to approach, whether you're an employer, whether you're a worker, and kind of policymakers locally. We got to engage on these issues because it really is one of the main economic issues that we face here. Hope that was somewhat helpful.
Thank you. And my question for Karin is, you talked about what we're doing here in Eugene to solve these problems. What can we learn from other communities? What are they doing that we haven't worked on yet?
It's a great question, and as we talked about, every community across the country is struggling with this issue. Not every community across the country is dedicating themselves to trying to address this issue, but the communities that are seeing progress. And I think that looking at some of the best practices or the paths that seem to be working could be very helpful to us. I would say in the research that Better Housing Together has done, the most inspiring projects that we have come across in other communities are very clearly stated initiatives that connect both elected representative leadership with business communities and nonprofit organizations, social services, the whole range of community interests, and make a clear sort of moonshot statement about what that community is trying to accomplish with regards to its housing. And how that presents in other communities is, you know, the sort of mayor's innovation, housing innovation lab in Boston, or the work that Philadelphia is doing around equitable development and planning. I think for Eugene, three things that we could think about, and this absolutely applies to Lane County as a whole, is steering our efforts towards diversity. We do not have the diversity of housing that we need in this community to support the community that we have, both in terms of workforce, but also our younger people in this community and our older members of the community. And that diversity of housing type supports a diversity of neighborhood and a diversity of community. And these are issues that we are trying to address and to see progress on. If we build the physical environment that supports us in those efforts, we will see greater progress. So steering our efforts towards housing diversity. That looks like some of the programs we have in place already, like, so for example, the city's multi-unit property tax exemption program, MUPTI, includes now a workforce housing requirement as a component of that program. That's a program we have in place. It is used occasionally. There's currently a project that is hoping to have that program support in order to be built in downtown Eugene. The purpose of that program is to fill in the gap between what is financially feasible and what a project is proposing to do. But that's already in place. What are other things that we might pursue? The other big category of work that communities are pursuing in terms of housing diversity has to do with addressing regulatory barriers that are unproductive, delivering education to the community to help people like this conversation today understand how housing diversity supports their interests and their hopes for community, and creating incentive programs related specifically to walkable communities, transit-oriented development, missing middle housing, and accessory dwelling units. We have talked a lot about those three things, transit-oriented development, missing middle housing, and accessory dwelling units over the last couple of years. Now we need to do the work to actually encourage the delivery of those homes into this market. Two other things that also relate to the first, expanding equity. Programs that focus on stabilizing home ownership and expanding access to home ownership are very effective when trying to support our workforce and build opportunity within those households and families. And then, of course, increasing resources and looking to the programs and the levers that we can pull as a community to bring more funding to some of these incredible challenges, because the workforce is not just a sort of separate segmented group within the community that doesn't interact with affordable housing or with market rate housing. But all of our policies need to see the connections between those things.
Okay, we'll go to other questions. We have three simple rules. Number one, to ask a question, you have to be a City Club member. If you are not, you can have a City Club member ask your question. Number two, be civil, of course. And the third one is you have a minute to ask a question, not to make a speech. So if you take more than a minute, I get to do this. So please avoid the bell. Thank you.
Ruth Demler, member. I didn't hear either of you mention RV parks. And now what I consider robbery is happening in our community. In Glenwood, Springfield has announced that all RV parks, once they're sold, must be emptied. That could mean thousands of homeless people on the street. Some of the people have lived there 30, 40, 50 years. What are we going to do? And I know St. Vinny is trying to buy up RV parks and on the outside and fix them up and include more people. But we need to do more than that. And as a community, I would like your suggestions.
That is a difficult question. There are, I think, a lot of layers in that relative to policy actions. And I think some good news is that this last legislative session did also look at increasing funding to support and also provide some alternatives for some of our, I think, lowest income households who are in a very unstable housing situation, what you're describing in that case. I think it speaks very clearly to the lack of alternatives that we have in this community, to the absence of a place to go to when you lose the housing that you've relied on or an absence of choices that are appropriate for your or your household's needs. And so when we're thinking about actions and policies and community efforts that support housing diversity, it's that range of alternatives that support stability, that encourage investment in place, and that give people a chance to make it through momentary crises and avoid long-term crisis. That's pretty critical to the work we have to do as a community. I don't have a simple answer to that particular question, but it's related to everything that we're talking about.
Randy Prince, City Club member. I don't particularly have much faith in supporting through incentives more single family or owner occupied homes, condos, any of this. The support we've given in the past has made the home ownership of the 60% of the population privileged, an enormous wealth generating mechanism, put down a small percentage, and in a market like ours, the gains are great, and with other things like mortgage tax deduction. As far as increasing supply to the point where rents, the market would actually drive prices down, I would ask if we looked at manufactured homes where instead of $200,000 construction cost minimum and they are less of an incentive for the investment of the trillions of dollars of home equity around the country, people who don't necessarily need a wage job. How many thousand units of manufactured homes in this area would actually make a dent to bring the price of workforce homes down, where the lot cost is small, the construction cost is a fraction of site-built homes? How many would you propose that we build instead of the current policy, which is eliminating, as in Glenwood and throughout, to build would actually affect the market to bring the price of home owner, of occupied rentals and owner homes? How many thousand units would we need here in Lane County to add instead of continuing to take away?
I have no idea the specific number. What I will say, just for context, I didn't talk about this in my comments, but actually, and was mentioned also with mobile home parks, they are really all part of an affordable housing strategy at all levels, and focusing on just one level won't be enough. So I cited, for example, that we built 50% of the housing that we did in the 1990s. We built a quarter of the 2-4 unit housing that we did in the 1990s. So these things are not impacted equally. I don't know any kind of numbers off the top of my head, but what I would say is each year that we get further from that historical average, that gap is growing likely. And so it's going to require, in some respects, an all-hands-on-deck approach to really try to make a dent in that. Karen, do you have more?
Maybe just a little bit of context. There's been some research done in the past couple of years, and Eco Northwest shared a report that basically identified that we're, I think, close to 200,000 housing units behind the needed supply in the state of Oregon. That's moves to 300,000 when you account for in-migration. And I'm summarizing a huge report in putting those numbers together. What that looks like locally, I mean, Henry talked about the lack of housing production relative to previous years that we've experienced recently. And I think one of the clear ways that impacts the availability of workforce housing is that when we don't build those units 20 years ago, they are not available now as a more affordable option. When we don't build those units 30 years ago, they're not available now. So there are several different ways to measure types of units that we're trying to supply in the market. You know, goals of providing 600 units of affordable housing or providing for 1,600 people who are experiencing homelessness. I think in terms of affecting the broad market of housing, the best thing we can do is make sure that we're making a concerted effort to deliver significant housing supply, and that most of that housing is meeting this median demographic need, because that's the housing that will be most accessible to more people as it ages over time. And that's where the missing middle policies, the accessory dwelling units, all of these pieces become so important in steering housing
manufactured
policy.
Home.
Todd Boyle, City Club member and retired certified public accountant and UO alum and all that stuff. This is my first time as a member, but the first time I attended City Club was at the top of the Citizens Building, because it was next door to our office up there. But now look at me, I'm a mess. So anyway, there are 20% of Eugenians, 20% of our neighbors who are trying to live on less than $1,000 a month. And for many, many years, their available housing has been decreasing, not increasing. And so as a result, these people have been continuously displaced out of town or to homelessness. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Census Bureau says that 17,000 people move here every year, and this is the city, and 2,000 stay, and 15,000 people leave, but those are the low-income people, and the people who stay tend to be higher-income people. So gentrification and inflicting this terrible stress on people being displaced. So my question is, what is Better Housing Together doing for the bottom 10% who can only afford $300 a month? And that's a capital cost of $50,000 a year, not $100. That's $50,000 a year will get you a mortgage for $300 a month that 20% of Eugenians can afford.
That is a great question, and I think hopefully clear in saying Better Housing Together being a community-led initiative. We have 50 partner organizations and businesses that we are working with in this effort. Our goal is to work collaboratively to address housing affordability and diversity and supply. Part of that is participating productively in conversations about how we provide for our most vulnerable residents. And part of that is also advocating for how we make sure that more people do not fall into that category. So there are many organizations locally who I would look to as our absolute experts on the issues that that you're describing, and who I would look to as the clearest voice of advocacy for those issues. I think the best things that Better Housing Together is doing right now to address that issue is very clearly advocating for simple implementation of state law that would allow people to have an accessory dwelling unit clearly incorporated on their property. That can be a unit that is 800 square feet, that can be a tiny house. There is work we have to do as a community about being clear that we support housing options and that we as a community also care about providing that housing to people who have fewer resources. So that's something that we're working on right now, and we hope that others will join in that effort. The City Council was talking about accessory dwelling units in Eugene just this past week, and I think needs to hear clearly from opinions from the community about how that type of housing could be a part of moving our efforts forward.
Okay, I'm John Annick, City Club member for quite a few years. It occurred to me that one of the problems that has not been mentioned here that affects prices is if you consider the entire Pacific Coast as a housing market. And one of the things that has happened in particular areas, like in the Bay Area, this astounding increase in prices. I sold my home in Palo Alto for 11 times what I paid for it. But that's peanuts compared to what it went for a few months ago. My daughter called me up on the phone about 7 months ago and said that my house, three bedroom, two bath with a family room and a good neighborhood, but not certainly not the most expensive neighborhood, sold for $3.4 million. So I blew it. I moved too soon. But anyway, this is something that ought to be considered. This is affecting prices here. Palo Alto has 20 times the population of Eugene, and that's just part of the Bay Area, and there are other parts of the Bay Area that are also more expensive. So there are a lot of people who get tired of the crowding and the lousy traffic in the Bay Area looking for some place to live, and they're going to be attracted to come up here. So the question is, given the context of being a part of a larger Pacific, Northern Pacific Coast housing market, what does that mean for the approach of this community to provide housing for people who aren't quite as wealthy as the average American family?
That's an excellent question. There's no question that, you know, to a certain respect, we have a national housing market that creates those kind of issues if you have a very overheated housing market like you have in many areas of California. I think it's something that we need to be aware of. You know, like I mentioned in my part of the presentation, we do get a lot of people that move here from California. That's probably pretty natural, given that it's the largest state and very close to us. People tend to move not very far. But it's something that we need to be, we need to all be approaching this problem together. Eugene can't solve this problem on its own. That being said, you know, whether this that particular issue is a driver of what we see here, I would say not likely to be on the top of the issue. I think the main, you know, the main reason that we see the issues that we do here has to do with housing supply and lower incomes nationally. Those are the primary drivers of it, but it's definitely something that we need to be aware of and considerate of.
John Dolo, City Club, and our table had some questions for Henry here, and maybe you can inform us a little bit more about what the ages, education, and family size are of the people that are moving in here.
Primarily, people that move tend to be younger. They tend to be single. This is in general, though people in the, you know, 18 to 35 age category are much more likely to move than other people. And that's just something you see across the U.S. You know, when people are in their root-setting years, that's when they tend to be moving. The people that move here to work in our workforce meet a lot of different types of profiles. Difficult to boil it down to just one. But since they're younger, they're earlier in their earning years, and often you see them with a lower income. You see lower income people moving. But that has much more to do with the fact that if you're 30, you're not likely to be earning as much as you are when you're 55. Not necessarily that they are, you know, necessarily in poverty, for example. Young families can move, but primarily, you know, people move here for the university. Some people do move here to retire, but a lot of the net movement that we get starts from the university, at least in this area.
Carmel Perez-Snyder, I'm with AARP, and I'm a member of City Club. The question is for both of you. As our population ages, and we are aging, by the year 2030, 1 in 5 adults will be over the age of 65. What will that impact, and how will that impact the need for housing options in Eugene and Lane County?
It's a great question, and takes us right back to that those points about diversity of housing options. We need much more housing in this community that is suitable to households of just a couple of people, not to single families, an expectation of two parents and a couple of children in that home. I think Eugene Springfield, we have almost 140,000 people who are over age 50. That means they're heading towards the years when no longer there are children in the home with them. And there are also really significant and somewhat startling statistics attached to how much savings the average American has relative to the equity that is in their home. So when we're thinking about the aging of this community, the opportunity to provide for, say, younger families, people in that demographic Henry just mentioned, 18 to 35, who may want to be moving somewhere, to provide a housing alternative for those long-term residents who've set down roots, who want to stay in the community, but do not want to care for a family home and a large parcel with yard work every weekend, that is part of this discussion and these policies. So incorporating more of the missing middle housing, duplexes, triplexes, quads, small apartment buildings, townhouses, row housing in our existing urban land, this allows for people to be a part of the community and remain a part of the community that they've been a part of for years or decades, which we know to be the best long-term sort of sociability and health scenario. But it also allows for the housing that they had lived in previously to be available to someone else. So as this community ages, we need more housing that is suitable to smaller households, and we need to think about how that can support the next generation of people who are wanting to have this be their home.
Cliff Gray, City Club member for quite a while. Anyway, I have One problem with what you say, the trickle-down value theory, you know, has been in effect for 100 years. And if that, if it was truly effective, we wouldn't be having this problem now. So I kind of differ with you on that very strongly. Plus, the workforce, the housing workforce ignored completely the incredible increases of rents that have been going on. You know, the rents are rising 11.76% in Eugene last April, 13% for Springfield, and they keep going up, which makes rentals themselves, which you want to build in abundance for middle class, unsustainable. So my question to you is, what happens to the lower income people who are going to be displaced? Are we going to throw them out of town? Are we going to watch a parade of homeless circle the city? And how are we going to deal with that in a concrete manner?
There are a lot of serious questions wrapped up in that question. So I'll try to answer a couple of them. And I want to be clear about a few things. I was not meaning to imply, and I don't think I said at all, that there is a vision of the work that Better Housing Together is doing that is not concerned with the real issues of this community. And by that, I mean housing affordability and diversity and supply across all income levels, and that supports the broad needs of the people who are here. So that I just wanted to be clear about. I think it's also important to understand that when we talk about the median income in this community, we're talking about a household income that Henry described as being below the state average, and is, I'm sure, related to the wages and the jobs that you're thinking of. So when we're talking about delivering housing that is accessible to those median incomes, it's why the affordability by design is so important. Because those households with that income are never going to be able to afford a $300, $400, $500, $1,000 home, the $3.4 million home the previous gentleman just mentioned. We need to do a much better job with our policies of creating pathways to build more housing that is more broadly affordable. Housing is inaffordable. Rents are so high because there is so little housing available. The market is high because the supply is low. That's a very simple concept related to these issues. If there is more supply of housing available, especially if that new housing is delivered at median incomes, that will dramatically influence, or at least improve significantly, the path that we are on with our housing policy. Where we're headed right now is not a good place. We are already in a crisis, and it will only get worse if we don't start to steer these efforts towards something that is more equitable and provides more of that missing middle-income housing, rent and to own.
I just wanted to add one other piece of context, too. You mentioned how construction companies respond to what they observe in the market. You know, is another example of these things take decades and decades to solve. We still don't have as many employees in the construction industry as we did in 2007. We still haven't come back to our previous level. We don't have the same number of construction businesses that we had in 2001. So the recession really had a dramatic impact here, and that does mean that local construction companies are not able to meet all the needs. So there are all types of different, you know, constraints on our ability to respond to this problem that we need to be conscious of. And I think that, as you mentioned, like those things do take quite a long time to solve. It's something that we need to be conscious of. So,
Emily Semple, City Club member. I'm bringing this interesting idea from one of my table mates. Since 3/4 of housing needed is low cost and workforce, why not require only low cost housing development and guarantee that guarantee affordability with a deed restriction?
It is an exciting idea, but I have a few thoughts about where it may run into some problems. But I think you all know what those problems are. It costs money to build housing. Lumber costs money, concrete costs money, labor costs money, windows, mechanical systems, any number of things. I'll put in a short plug that, again, the more of our housing that we can move towards energy efficiency over time, the lower those costs over time will be for the people who live in those homes. But the scenario that you're describing would simply require really significant public investment in that outcome. What you're describing is essentially an expansion of our affordable housing efforts to incorporate workforce housing broadly and middle incomes, and it would just mean bringing significantly larger financial resources to that challenge. It's why this challenge is so difficult, because again, the families, this missing middle, right, who you would be asking for that funding, are the very families who are struggling currently with stability in the market that is so difficult. It's a really challenging political nut to crack, but the path to the future you're describing is simply more funding or a publicly funded building culture, so to speak. It would not be nearly as efficient or cost-effective as the skilled trades that we have in place in terms of using them to deliver this housing. One interesting aside to that is that with the passage of Measure 102 last year, the Portland Housing Bond that was passed the year before just recently announced that they have exceeded all of their targets as a result of the passing of that policy change. So really, really great example. You can find out more about that by going to the Oregon Housing Alliance Facebook page or website. But a really good example of how steering our policies to better integrate the public and private sector response and to bring more energy, more resources to these issues is the path to better outcomes. That's at least what we're seeing bared out in significant number for significant families just to the north in Portland.
Ty Pruce Zimmerman, I'm a City Club member as of today. And I was curious about demographics. Roughly half of our population is rent burdened, with the 60% of renters and 30% of homeowners, meaning roughly half is not. And I was curious if there are any distinct demographic differences between those groups and what demographic groups might be disproportionately burdened by this problem we're facing.
Probably the easiest example is folks who bought their homes many decades ago in a different housing market, essentially, are much less likely to be burdened. If you look at demographics on units without a mortgage, for example, through the census, so definitely an age distinction to be made there. And then as well, everything that goes along with that. The folks who lived in Lane County 30 years ago aren't the same as the people that move in yesterday. So. There's an equity element to that, and so it's tough to, again, kind of change that overnight, but that's something that we need to be aware of.
There's also a really significant difference in the access to opportunity that has been available in this community with regards to paths to homeownership over the past many decades, sort of in the history of the United States, and that as we're thinking about policies and programs that expand equity, we are also thinking about expanding opportunities to communities who have been historically underserved by our housing efforts and by our communities, and specifically homeownership among communities of color, certainly, of course, homeownership among immigrant communities, much lower than people who are white and have been in those communities for a long time. So there's definitely work to do on simply the sort of opportunity and access half of this equation.
All right. I'd like to thank you both for being here. This is Eric Richardson, President of City Club, one more time. Really happy to hear about all the good work that and research that is going into this difficult problem. And I just would encourage all our listeners and members to stay involved with this problem as we go forward. It really does matter that we do this collectively. Before we have one final thank you to our guests today, I'd like to have a couple announcements. I'd like to thank our gold sponsors, Sacred Earth Botanicals, the Oregon Country Fair, Network Charter School, and a special thanks to KRVM 91.9 Radio. And thank you to radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Monday nights at 6:30. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club events. Next week, we will be in Bend for our conversation and continuation of our program about the confrontation at the Mile Hair. We will live stream the program here at the Baker Center, so we'd hope you come back. For those listening, come on down to the Baker Center, 12 o'clock next Friday, to hear about this great program. We're also asking for your help. In December, we will have Gifts to the City program, a program we have annually where we ask speakers to come and think about if they had the power, the superpower to gift the city something, what would it be? So this is your chance to help us with the upcoming program. So please bring your ideas with guest gift givers to Silver or to me. For more details and information about future programs, you can go online to our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now let's thank our speakers, Corinne Knudsen and Henry Fields. Thank you.